court is ready to hear argument in 060502 Jan Ogletree, M.D. and Heart Hospital of Boston versus Nancy K. Matthews and Luann Matthews.
May it please the court, Ms. Harris and Ms. Atwood will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Harris will open with the first 8 minutes, and Ms. Harris will present the rebuttal.
Two issues are before this court regarding Dr. Ogletree. One, the jurisdiction issue, and two, whether a 30-day extension allows a plaintiff to get a new report from a new expert that was not timely filed within the 120 days under the new statute. I will address jurisdiction first. The case that was just before us under the old law is precisely one of the reasons the legislature enacted the new law to allow us to be here today. As Justice Brister pointed out in the prior argument, there are different parts of the state that seem to interpret the expert requirement and the new law differently. That is precisely why we are here. 11 of the 14 Court of Appeals have now, as we stand here today, addressed the jurisdictional issue under the new statute. When we did our briefs on the merits, I believe there were only four or five. Since I only have 8 minutes as I go along, I will try to give cites to the new cases. If the court wishes, I can certainly do a post-submission brief as to the new cases because these appear to be coming out literally almost weekly.
That would be helpful.
I will be glad to do that, Your Honor. As Justice Brister and Justice Heck pointed out in In Re Women's Hospital case before this court under the old law, in addressing whether you can mandamus under the old law, both of you pointed out in your dissent in the denial of the mandamus, quote, just recently as part of House Bill 4, the legislature amended 51.014 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code to provide for an interlocutory appeal if a trial court refuses to dismiss a health care liability claim when an expert statement does not meet the statutory standards. This is another unmistakable statement of public policy that the legislature does not want healthcare liability cases to proceed through the legal system if the threshold requirement of an expert report has not been met. That is exactly what we have here, and that's exactly why the legislature has allowed an interlocutory appeal in these cases.
What did the legislature mean when it said an appeal may not be taken from an order granting an extension under 74.351?
What that means, that was precisely the issue in the Andra case out of the Austin Court of Appeals. That, when I have this happen often in my cases, a plaintiff will file an expert report way prior to the 120 days. And in fact, I just got a new lawsuit last week where the expert report was attached to the petition. That means I've only got 21 days to object to that, which sometimes is even before my answer is due, which is a whole another issue that's not before this court. But in that case, if I file an objection within 21 days, the other side has a right to set it for hearing, or I could set it for hearing. I typically wouldn't. I'd wait and let the 120 days run. But the other side, typically, if they're smart, will set it for hearing. If the court rules that expert report is inadequate, but gives them an additional 30 days to cure that deficiency, I can't appeal that because that is an extension for an inadequate report, which is precisely cannot be appealed under the statute. What can be appealed is the failure to grant a motion to dismiss that should have been granted. Now, inherently in that, obviously, the court is going to have to look at not only what the trial court did in deciding on the motion to dismiss, but any issues down the road. In other words, did they give a 30-day extension? Were the reports an objective good faith effort? And each one of the cases that has held jurisdiction has held that the statute clearly says dismissal under B is subject to C.
But a motion for extension to cure deficiency implies that the expert report is not adequate as it is, right?
If the trial court grants an extension, yes. The trial court is saying you made an objective good faith effort, but it wasn't quite good enough, and we're giving you an additional 30 days to cure that deficiency. That's exactly what that's saying.
How would you decide the motion to dismiss in that vacuum, knowing that it's going to be supplemented and the deficiency's cured? How would the trial court be able to rule on the motion to dismiss?
In this case, and in the cases that have gone up on appeal, it's the fact that the trial court had no discretion to give the 30-day extension, and therefore it was wrong to deny the motion to dismiss. And because the trial court got it wrong in not granting the motion to dismiss, then got it wrong again by giving a 30-day extension
I guess that's my question, though, is how do you know when you've gotten it wrong? If it's inadequate, then technically the trial court's gotten it wrong by not dismissing. But the statute allows discretion to allow it to be cured.
Only if, one scenario, if there is a timely filed report from a qualified expert and the elements are there, okay, standard of care, breach, causation, but it is deficient, then that person can cure that deficiency.
Deficient how?
For example, usually the one that's found the most is conclusory. For example, somebody says, here's the standard of care, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Which we've held to be, in other cases, basically no evidence. So you're filing an expert report that doesn't have any real content, and you're saying that you do get an extension in that case to cure that deficiency?
If the trial court finds that it's an objective good faith effort, absolutely.
And the trial court found that here?
The trial court didn't find at all in this case.
Well, implicitly by granting the motion for extension, if that's the standard, then the court found a good faith effort.
It is the standard. The trial court did not articulate the standard. What the trial court said, which gets into the second point but is inherently important in this one as well, what the trial court held was the three reports as to Dr. Ogletree is a urologist, and this has to do with inserting a catheter in the bladder. The one report they got, the only physician report they got, was Dr. Karsh, who is a pediatric cardiologist and a radiologist. His report doesn't even mention Dr. Ogletree by name at all in his report. The other two reports
were... But you can tell from the report itself clearly who it's referring to, if it says the doctor that placed the catheter, and I haven't looked at the affidavits, but if it says the doctor who placed the catheter was negligent in X, surely that would be an objective good faith effort, even though the doctor's not named.
Not according to the courts of appeals that have interpreted the new law. In fact, the San Antonio Court of Appeals in the Garcia case said that if a defendant is not mentioned by name, it's as if no report was filed as to that person at all.
Well, but I would think if the record clearly demonstrates and there's no dispute as to who the doctor was, that might be a different scenario.
If there was only one defendant, say, in the case, and that was the only issue, and instead of saying Dr. Ogletree, for example, they said defendant did this, then arguably the trial court could say, you know, that's a good faith effort. Go back and change defendant to Dr. Ogletree
in your
30 days.
What I'm trying to understand is I'm the judge, and I get, you know, and there's a motion to dismiss. The expert report is in front of me, and I determine that it's conclusory. And I look at Supreme Court precedent that says it's no evidence. And am I then obligated to dismiss the case at that point, or does the statute give me the power to grant a 30-day extension?
The statute gives you the power to grant a 30-day extension.
Even when the report doesn't, there's no evidence as to causation or standard or what?
No, in that case, absolutely not.
Well, that's what conclusory is. So what I'm trying to understand is, does the statute give the trial court the authority to grant this 30-day extension to cure deficiencies like conclusory, or does it not?
No, it does not, Your Honor. It specifically says it only can cure the deficiency in the report. The courts of appeals that have looked at it, for example, if no report is filed at all, if a report is filed, as in this case, the only causation report was from a nurse who statutorily is prohibited from giving causation opinions and standard of care as to a doctor. Reports that deal with another defendant and don't mention a defendant at all, those are clearly not an objective good faith effort, and the court has no discretion in that case under the statute to give a 30-day extension, which is what we had in this case. The only way the court can give an extension is if they find an element, a sentence. It's almost semantics. It's to the point where the few times that I have actually filed a motion to dismiss on what I consider to be an inadequate report, the trial court will say, add the sentence, change the sentence. It's not even worth the time. Those good lawyers would never file a motion to dismiss on a report that was probably an objective good faith effort, which is not what we have
here.
So
if it's an objective good faith effort, then there's really no need to cure, is what you're saying. It would be improper to dismiss.
It would be absolutely improper to dismiss. The court could make them fix it, but in the grand schemes of the case, it's a valid case. It's going to go forward. Whether the sentence says Dr. Ogletree versus defendant is immaterial to the substance.
Well, I don't understand why there would be that provision in the statute to grant time for curing a deficiency if it really doesn't matter in terms of whether the trial court must dismiss or not. I just don't know.
Well, it may matter to other defense attorneys. I was just talking about me in particular. What the statute says is if you don't make the effort at all, either don't get a report or your reports mention other defendants or your reports are so deficient that it's clearly not an objective good faith effort, then you cannot give a 30-day extension. And that is what we had in this case. If, for example, they left out a medical term or they left out a procedure that was done or you found maybe just causation was conclusory, then it's an objective good faith effort. You can go back and add that. Under any of the scenarios that we've discussed here today, this court has jurisdiction to hear that, and the Austin Court of Appeals erred by finding that there was no jurisdiction. What the Austin Court of Appeals tried to say was only if the trial court denies a motion to dismiss and denies an extension, does this court have jurisdiction, which completely ignores the whole subsection B allowing for an interlocutory appeal, and it allows the trial courts to say, you know what, I don't like the statute, I'm going to deny the motion to dismiss, but I'm going to grant you 30 days because then I know the Supreme Court can't touch me and we're going to go forward. And that's exactly what will happen if jurisdiction is not allowed in this case.
If you grant the 30 days, you just move forward again in 30 days, right?
Well, the problem is in this case is the trial court allowed them to get a new expert.
Right. Separate question. If they just use the same expert, then you just file it again. What's the harm in waiting an additional 30 days?
Well, we learned from the Waco Court of Appeals in Lewis that's not appealable either. That's exactly what happened in that case. They went ahead and waited the 30 days, got the new report, complained the new report wasn't good enough, dismissed that, went up to the Waco Court of Appeals. Waco Court of Appeals said you can't appeal your first motion to dismiss that should have been dismissed initially because you didn't file an interlocutory appeal within 20 days. You can't file the second one because there's no jurisdiction under the statute.
But assuming we didn't feel ourselves bound by what the Waco Court of Appeals said, we could look at, if it's just a matter of trial judge gives you 30 days, you wait 30 days, you file a new motion to dismiss saying it's still not. I mean, if you've gotten a full report, then no harm, no foul. But if the report's still inadequate, you can just move again, and then you unquestionably have a right to interlocutory review.
Well, the harm in that in this case is there was no report that could have been fixed. You've got a radiologist and two nurses. What the trial court did was allow them to go get a new expert from a new report from a new expert, which clearly it is not allowed and defeats the whole 120 days. And I need to let Ms. Atwood have some time to argue, and I can address any other questions in rebuttal.
We'll hear from Ms. Atwood.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's undisputed in this case that at the 120-day deadline for filing expert reports, the Matthews had filed absolutely no report that even attempted to address the causation issue for the hospital or the nursing standard of care. The Matthews and the Austin Court of Appeals take the position that this omission of a required report is somehow cured by the fact that there was not an objection to the two nursing reports that did not, because they could not, address causation in the case. This court will recall that the legislature changed the law in the state to expressly prohibit nurses and require physicians to provide causation testimony, the causal nexus between the alleged breach of the standard of care and injury or death or damages to the plaintiff. That can only be provided now by a physician expert in a medical malpractice case. Previously, that could be provided by a nurse or other healthcare professional under certain circumstances. In this case, the nursing reports that were provided were perfectly appropriate and were not objectionable as they were provided. They properly addressed the standard of care, properly addressed the breach of the standard of care, and these nurses were qualified to address that issue. They also properly refrained from discussing the causation issue in the case.
But under your argument, could you have waited 2 years rather than raise this objection 2 years later?
Your Honor, there is no requirement for a timeliness requirement for a motion to dismiss. And in fact, when there is an absence of a report under the statute, the only correct vehicle to proceed is a motion to dismiss and not an objection in this case. And I think what the Court of Appeals, where they missed the boat and the core error that they made was messing up or mixing up the function of an objection and a motion to dismiss. We are directed by the statute to look at the specific report to determine whether it implicates the conduct of a defendant to decide whether you need to evaluate it and make an objection in any case. In this situation, clearly the reports of the nurses implicated the conduct of the hospital in this case. But to rule that the hospital would then have to make an objection that the nurses failed to address causation when they can't address causation stands on its head the legislative intent.
But it says it's any objection must file and serve any objection to the sufficiency of the report. Why wouldn't this be, if your objection is they don't and nobody else addresses causation, why wouldn't that be any objection to the sufficiency of the reports?
Well, Your Honor, for the exact reason that the Austin court mixed up the function of objections. There's no context in the law where we object to omitted testimony. The role and function of an objection is to raise deficiencies in the testimony given. That's true with summary judgment affidavits, with testimony from witnesses at trial. You object if there is some deficiency or problem with the offered testimony. You don't object when there has been an omission of testimony.
As I read C, it treats experts' reports that are deficient as if they had never been served at all. If an expert report has not been served within the period specified by Subsection A, because elements of the report are found deficient.
Right.
So it seems to equate a deficient report with one that's not been served at all. It treats them as if they've never been served at all.
Well, I do think, Your Honor, that, I mean, unfortunately, the legislature chose three different words to use in the same section of the statute. They talked about objection to sufficiency, and then they talked about deficient reports. And I think really the issue before this court is probably whether those are mirror images of one another. And then it talks about dismissal if a report is found to be inadequate. I mean, that's where the ambiguity arises. But if I may conclude briefly, Your Honor, that...
Let me ask you, as I read your brief, it seems to indicate that by not having any report address causation as to the hospital, that there was no report as to the hospital on causation, which, as you pointed out, causation is required to be opined to by a physician now.
That's correct.
And you seem to distinguish sufficiency of a report that's made
right, from
no filing of a report at all. The latter case you say you don't have to object to. The former, you say you do.
That's correct.
Would you equate sufficiency and adequacy under this statute? Adequate report versus a sufficient report, would you say they're similar or the same?
No, I think that they're different issues to be decided. Sufficiency has to do with the sufficiency of the areas addressed in the report. In other words, maybe the nurse didn't sufficiently address standard of care and breach because she had insufficient detail, or perhaps she's not qualified, or there's some problem with it. And if I don't object to that, I'm going to waive my right to complain about the content of what she said.
And adequacy?
Adequacy, on the other hand, when it's referred to in the last section there of 731, is talking about whether the plaintiff has met their entire burden to provide the trifecta or the tripartite complement of the expert reports. And don't lose sight of the fact that the legislature said, you know, we're going to require in all of these hospital cases, effectively, that the plaintiff provide at least two reports, one addressing the standard of a care from a nurse or pharmacist, physical therapist, any non-physician health care provider whose conduct could be challenged. And we're going to also need to provide an extra separate report from a physician on the element of causation. Because we expect that people are going to need to provide separate reports, we're directed to look for the sufficiency of the testimony or the sufficiency of the opinions offered in the report that you have in front of you. That doesn't mean that it gives a plaintiff a pass where they don't have to ever provide a report on causation when they have provided a perfectly sufficient, perfectly adequate report from a qualified expert, limited properly to those topics that that expert can address under the statute.
Further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument now from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Young will present argument for the respondent.
Counsel, do you agree that we need to parse out sufficiency versus a deficient report versus an adequate report here? And if so, how do you define those consistent with the language and purposes of this section?
Sufficiency and adequacy. I'm not sure that we do have to parse those out, but I do believe that in determining whether a report is sufficient under the criteria of whether or not there can be the finding of merit would require that all of the elements be met, all three of the tripartite elements be met.
Why shouldn't we be able to review an affidavit to determine in the first instance if it constitutes an objective good faith effort, separate and apart from whether it can be cured by a continuance?
An affidavit, Your Honor?
Yes. If the trial court abused its discretion in finding that the affidavit was an objective good faith effort, why should the court not be able to review it on appeal interlocutorily?
By affidavit, you're talking about the reports themselves?
Yes.
I believe that what we have here is the legislative intent to grant broad discretion to the trial court to determine if a report is filed, whether or not an extension can be granted.
And you think that's essentially unlimited?
I think it is unlimited as long as a report has been filed.
What if the report is from a plumber?
Then certainly no, that does not set the predicate.
What if the report has words but doesn't say anything about linking anything that the hospital or doctor did to the death or injury of the plaintiff? It's a report, but it just doesn't do anything.
And I think that there could potentially be cases where there is a report that, quote-unquote, is not a report.
So this gets us back, I think, to Justice O'Neill's question, and that is, why shouldn't the trial court be able to look first whether the report filed is a good faith effort, and then, if it is, permit the curing of deficiencies in that report?
And I believe that is what the cases require, and that is what is implied when a court grants the 30-day extension.
And why can't we review the trial court's decision as to whether it constitutes an objective good faith effort in the first instance? So if, as the chief posited, a plumber had filed the report, why can't we review that regardless of whether the trial court granted an extension?
And I believe that we have to look at the legislative intent to expedite these cases, to give the trial court, much like in a summary judgment case, a lot of discretion in determining whether or not a 30-day extension is granted. And then at that point, after that 30-day extension is granted, there typically is another hearing, at which case everything is reviewed by the court. And I think that is the key in this new statute, is the discretion that the legislature intended by prohibiting an appeal. It's specifically adding language prohibiting an appeal where a 30-day extension is granted, basically kicking the appellate process to the next level after that 30 days has run.
Doesn't it just prohibit the review of the order granting the extension?
As I read it, it prohibits an appeal of an order that includes an extension.
Okay, so as you read it, once the extension is granted, that's it. There's no further review forever of the adequacy or sufficiency or of anything in regard to the reports.
Up to that level, I believe that is correct, Your Honor.
Well, at any point, when would it be reviewable? After trial, before trial? In your view, is the adequacy and sufficiency of the report or reports ever reviewable if the trial court grants an extension?
I believe that, as I said, there is typically a second hearing after the 30 days.
No, not typically. Is it ever reviewable, as you view it, under your scenario, by an appellate court?
I believe not. I believe that was the legislative intent in specifically adding the provision that it would not be reviewable, that there would not be jurisdiction. Much as in the new statute, there is no appeal on the qualifications hearing under L of Section 74.351, except by the plaintiff that might lose that hearing.
Is it true that some judges who just don't believe there should be this requirement are ignoring it?
I believe that is true, and I believe that there have been cases where the appellate courts, and I believe properly, have said if there were no reports filed at all, then the precedent for granting a 30-day extension was not satisfied. Therefore, the appellate court did have jurisdiction.
But are you saying a judge could get a judge that disagreed with what the legislature passed could get around it by just granting a 30-day extension?
No. I believe that the courts of appeals, in the case where there is no report at all, should be allowed to say that you abused your discretion because there was no report at all.
But you also think, just to be clear, that sometimes a report can be so deficient that it's no report, like a report from a plumber.
Yes, a report from a plumber.
The question, in your view, on this issue, it all boils down to what does deficient mean in paragraph C.
I believe that that is correct. But I believe in looking at what is deficient, again, the statute is very clear that you have to look at all of the reports in toto as one report. And what was filed were three reports, one of which was by an MD, total of some, I believe, 25 pages of discussion regarding the actions by the hospital and the doctor.
Help me with the argument. The defendant is supposed to object to the nurse's report because it doesn't address causation when it can't address causation. How can you object to something which doesn't have something in it that it can't have in it?
First of all, I believe that the nurse's reports did talk about causation.
They should have.
And that is improper. But that goes as to qualifications, whether or not they are qualified to talk about causation. And that is certainly a matter that would require an objection and a hearing on that objection. And the
if the nurse's reports were properly in a case, were properly silent on the issue of causation, they just didn't touch it because they're not supposed to.
Right.
Should the defendant object to those reports?
I believe so, whereas in this case it's clear, I believe, that the plaintiffs were relying on those reports to satisfy the statute. They were served with a doctor's report that at least made some reference to the hospital. Granted, it did not adequately address the causation issue. The doctor's report. But the three reports taken together talked at length about the action of the nurses, and it was filed the day before the 120 days period ran. So it's not a situation where it was filed with the petition or in the first few weeks after the petition was filed, and the nurses or the hospital needed to wait to see if another report was filed by the doctor. So I think that in this case, the hospital was clearly on notice that these three reports in toto were being relied upon by the plaintiff as their reports, and therefore they had an obligation to file an objection.
Counsel, the opposing counsel said that you actually, in looking at the nurse's standard of care and causation, would be required to file both a nurse and a physician's affidavit to get the standard of care and causation, as I understood her argument. Would you be able to get both of those, both standard of care and causation, with a physician affidavit?
I believe you could. Okay. With the correct physician, depending
right,
on his qualification.
Right, with the correct physician. The physician, in other words, can testify about a nurse standard of care as well as causation. Nurse, on the other hand, can only go to standard of care and not causation. And it's up to the plaintiff to choose which of those affidavits or all of them they want to file.
That is correct. And again, I believe that because of the discretion that is allowed to the trial court, that the appeal by Dr. Ogletree of the 30-day extension is prohibited. The court does not have jurisdiction, and that, in essence, to rule otherwise, Dr. Ogletree would have to show this court that the reports that were filed were, in essence, no reports at all. And I don't believe that that is the case. When you look at the reports, they clearly implicate Dr. Ogletree. They talk at length about what he did. And I believe that is enough to give the trial court the discretion to grant the 30-day extension. There was a subsequent hearing and no appeal from it after the reports were filed. As to the issue of regarding whether or not another expert can be used, I think there are some cases that do say that is okay and they have allowed that. The only one that I saw that didn't was the Danos case out of Houston, where the trial court said, no, I granted a 30-day extension, but I'm not going to allow a new expert. And I believe that's perfectly within the discretion of the trial court, since the trial court granted the 30-day extension. In our case, after the 30-day extension was granted, or actually before it was granted, but after the 120 days, we did file a report of a urologist, a very eminent urologist of UCLA Medical School, very detailed report. And within the 30-day extension, there was also a report filed, a supplemental report filed by Dr. Karsh, the original physician that filed the short report within the 120 days. After reviewing Dr. Klayman's, the urologist, report, he supplemented his report and incorporated that report. So we did not rely totally upon the expert report by the new doctor. I believe that as to the hospital, you know, the 21 days is pretty clear. I think that the legislature intended hard and fast deadlines here. They wanted to expedite these cases. They wanted to get rid of the cases that don't have merit, and I don't believe that's the situation in our case. Certainly, neither of the judges that heard the two hearings on these on the motions by these defendants felt that this was a meritless case and denied their motions to dismiss after reviewing the reports. And I believe that the 21 days is a hard and fast rule intended by the legislature to make the defendant speak up early as opposed to waiting until this case gets 2 years down the road just before trial and start filing motions to dismiss. And I believe that if you look at it, it also is a situation where the 21-day objection notice, and in fact the objection notice in general, is intended to create a fair playing field whereby if the defendants have a problem with the reports, that they put the plaintiff on notice of those problems so that the plaintiff then can request a 30-day extension to correct those reports. And again, all of this being in a timely fashion so that there can be a quick determination of whether these are meritorious cases that need to go forward.
What's the specific objection that you claim the hospital should have made here in this case?
I believe that they should have stated that objected that the reports in total, and looking at all three of them, failed to properly address the causation issue as required by the statute.
And your counterpart says that the plaintiffs have an affirmative duty under the statute to file a report that affirmatively addresses causation in a proper way.
Correct.
So whose burden is it?
It is the plaintiff's burden to file a report.
And then the defendant's burden to point out problems so that you can fix them.
Correct. I believe that that is the purpose, one of the purposes of the 30-day extension granted to the discretion of the trial court to say, okay, we've got a problem. It's been pointed out by the defendants, and I want to give the plaintiffs 30 days to cure that. And then, as is typical, there's another hearing at the end of the 30 days to determine whether or not the statute has then been satisfied.
And as you read the statute, so long as there's some written document called a report served, then the defendant has an obligation to point out deficiencies within the 21 days.
I believe that is correct. Again, going back to what Chief Justice stated, you know, if it's a plumber's report, I don't believe that that gets
you
there.
Doesn't the statute treat a nurse's opinion on causation just like it would a plumber's report on causation? It says neither one is sufficient. Neither one is appropriate on causation.
It does say that a nurse's opinion on causation is improper, but it does. Nurses are allowed to proffer opinions regarding a number of issues.
Yeah, but we're just talking about causation here. And not to belittle nurses, but when it comes to giving an expert report on causation, the statute treats them like plumbers, doesn't it?
I don't know that it treats them like plumbers.
Well, it says except only a physician may testify on causation.
So no one else in the world except a physician can provide an expert report on causation. So everyone else in the world but physicians are treated the same for purposes of the statute with regard to causation.
I can see the court's argument in that regard, and I don't necessarily disagree with that.
Is it an argument, or is it the way the statute's drafted?
I believe the statute is drafted that way. By the same token, the plaintiffs did present a doctor's report, albeit brief, that did reference, albeit brief, the nurses and the actions by the nurses. It did not go into causation as would be required to satisfy the statute.
I don't want to pile on here, but Ms. Atwood seemed to make a pretty compelling argument as it pertains to that report. But it seems to me that your argument, unless I missed it, is that you took in totality all three of these reports and therefore that was adequate enough to meet the requirements to put the hospital on notice of your claims. Is that right?
That is correct. And in closing, I think that the key here is looking at what the legislature intended as far as giving the trial courts a lot of discretion. I've mentioned this before, but I believe that they have a lot of discretion in granting the 30 days, and I believe that Dr. Ogletree is trying to circumvent that discretion by saying that this report is not a report at all. And I just don't believe that that is the case. And I don't believe that the two trial courts that looked at these reports felt that this was a non-meritorious case. And they both felt that it should go forward. And similarly, the trial court that heard the hospital's argument felt that an objection was proper, again, to allow the plaintiff to correct any perceived deficiencies in that report as taken as a whole.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Let me ask, as you're walking up, did you move to dismiss after the second round of reports?
Did not.
Do you agree that those supplemental reports cured deficient? Were they deficient? Were they sufficient?
Yes, and I objected to them.
Right.
Yes, but have not filed an appeal on that motion to dismiss. Yes, I filed an objection. Yes, I filed a motion to dismiss, but this has been pending, and there was no report as to Dr. Ogletree filed, period. There were two nursing reports filed, which the court knows can't address standard of care causation or breach as to Dr. Ogletree. The only doctor report.
So if we were to disagree with you on the merits of this appeal, it would go back down to the trial court and there'd be another hearing on the motion to dismiss? Is that?
No, Your Honor. The trial court had no discretion but to dismiss the case.
No, I'm saying let's just assume that we disagree with that. The trial court had plenty of discretion not to dismiss the case, to grant the extension, not to dismiss. And that's what we held. Would the posture be that it goes back down to the trial court and the trial court would then hear your motion to dismiss based on the inadequacy of the new report?
Yes, if I chose to have that heard. Sure, absolutely. Otherwise, we just go to trial or continue with the case.
Sometimes it's kind of hard to tell whether a physician is going to be in the area of expertise to be able to testify, because it's very close. So you bring in an expert that's kind of in one area related to the claims, but the trial court says, well, no, I don't think that does it. I think what we need here is not an expert in this area, but one in this area. Why shouldn't you get, it seems to me you almost have to have a second expert in that case.
If the trial court found that the first expert was not qualified?
No.
Absolutely. Either they have to get a second one if that was allowed. The 120-day, in this case, the 120-day deadline, there was no report filed as to Dr. Ogletree. There was a letter, a report from Dr. Karsh that says, I'm not qualified to address urology standard of care. The only thing he says in there is, I would defer to a urologist, and these questions are better asked of a urologist. It is not an expert report by any means, and nobody claims it is.
But if he said, I think I am, and the trial judge disagreed, why couldn't you go get a second expert?
Because then that defeats the entire purpose of having the 120-day deadline that the legislature enacted. It's not the trial court's job to go tell a plaintiff's attorney how to work up his case.
But if the attorney thinks in good faith that this expert ought to qualify, but the trial judge disagrees, then the case is just over in your view.
It is over, although they could certainly appeal
the granting of the motion under L, then that is certainly appealable as well. But the Danos case, which counsel referred to, is a new Houston Court of Appeals case. And in that case, the court said the legislative intent and the language of the statute says you only get 30 days to cure the deficiency in the report. And they compare that with what we were allowed to do under the old statute 4590I, which says you get 30 days to comply with the subsection. The Danos court said, as this court has held many times, when the legislature changes the language, you've got to give intent to that. Under the old 4590I, you could comply with the subsection, i.e., you could go get a new report from a new expert. Under the new one, it says you only can cure the deficiencies in the report. And that is why the Houston Court of Appeals said you only can fix what's there.
Other questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise.